Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 89 featuring David Wortley from Taylor James in the UK. They actually have an office in New York as well and a few more coming up. But he is a fantastic person. He has been part of the betas for us for a long, long time. He's a sort of a TD over at Taylor James. Taylor James is a very unique company, interesting. They do a lot of print media and as well as other commercial work. And I'm really going to let David tell you more about that because he's a pretty interesting guy. I love talking to him. He's very chatty, very fun, really cool guy to hang out with. I've never really met him until we recorded a podcast because we've only known each other online. It's funny how you get to know these people online for a long time and you never really meet them, and then you meet them in person and then it's just like you've known each other for a long time. I love that about the internet. All right. It's just me doing the podcast intro today. A couple of announcements. Let's see. Phoenix 3.0 for 3D Studio Max is available. So go check it out. And if you do that, you can go check it out on our fabulous new website, which if you haven't checked out, you should. So it's a really cool thing to do. So check out the new stuff for Phoenix. Lots of great stuff done in there. Lots of amazing fluid stuff done. Lots of cool presets. It's much easier to use for a lot of reasons. So go check out what's new in Phoenix and our new website. And go make sure and browse that. We got some really great reviews about our new website, so we're very, very happy about it. It looks like people are enjoying it. And I'd love to hear what you guys have to say about it as well. By the time this podcast comes out, I will be in Lisbon. And I will be, well, not in Lisbon, I'll be in Portugal. I'll be in Troia for Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. I'll be recording a bunch of podcasts there. Again, reminder, if there's anyone you want to hear, let me know about that. And I would love to do a podcast with him while I'm there. I'm planning on doing a whole bunch, so make sure and check those out. Also, make sure to check out all our social stuff. I know you've been growing quite a bit. Sean has told us recently that our Instagram page has grown a great deal, which is really fun, and a lot of great work is being posted up there, so go check that out. And make sure and review this podcast if you can. Go to iTunes if you're looking at this on iTunes and give us a rating. Rate all of the episodes, leave comments. You can also leave comments on the podcast page itself, which is great. And I also want to remind people to check out the actual podcast page, even if you're just downloading this from your podcast app, to go check out the page. There's also a lot of great content that we put up there for people to check out, so it's also a good place to go. All right, guys, thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I think you and I have known each other through the forums and the beta forum and all that stuff for years now.
Yeah, it's been...
How long have you been on the forums and stuff? V-Ray user and stuff?
Well, I started using V-Ray when I started at Taylor James about 9 years ago.
Okay.
When it was, I think it was 1.5 in those days.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I got involved with the beta for 2. And then I've been involved like pretty closely with the beta team and like emailing Vlado pretty much every day since, I think.
Yeah. And he's very responsive.
Yeah. I don't think the guy sleeps.
I don't think he does.
No. He must have like... Just like he must have cloned himself. That's the only conclusion I've come to now, is that he doesn't sleep and he's got multiple people. Like, there must be this kind of like the real, who is the real Vlado?
And I think I know for a fact that he's got very, very good people working with him. But as far as the way that he communicates with the world, it's definitely Vlado.
Yeah. I think there's quite a few software companies that could take a good lesson from the kind of the ownership that he has over everything.
I think it's a hard act to follow, though, because that's the kind of dedication that I think few people have the capability of doing. But we'll see. We'll see. All right. So how did you get to Taylor James? Well, first of all, should we explain Taylor James?
Yeah, it's one of those companies where people have probably seen our work, but you know, we're not the kind of the big names like the Mill, DNAG, and everything like that.
Right.
But you know, we come up against them in quoting. We do jobs that they do as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Taylor James is a post production creative house. Started 16 years ago. I've got the full corporate spiel here. And it's so originally it was photo retouching, so just doing print advertising. And then about 10 years ago, they found they were doing lots of retouching with this new medium of CGI, which was mm-hmm. coming into advertising, and mainly through automotive, because with these big metal heaps that, you know, getting them around the country
right.
when they haven't necessarily been finished and quite expensive to hide from the public when they're code red products. You know, people suddenly started realizing that CGI was a good route to do for this.
Uh-huh.
So about 10 years ago, we started looking at that, and then it was a case of, hey, we should be doing our own CGI. So the CGI department was formed, and I joined it when it was quite young, so about 9 years ago, straight out of university,
mm-hmm.
Coming for some sort of fairly kind of ambitious projects we were doing, trying to do some kind of cool digital motion stuff. And yeah, I've kind of been stuck there ever since. I'm kind of, they keep trying to get rid of me, I think, but you know, it's,
really?
Well,
why would they get rid of
me? No. I'm just,
So what did you study in university?
So I did computer animation at Portsmouth University in the
UK.
Oh,
right. Yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, it's a good uni. It has, the years that I was there, we had some really good students. So uh-huh. it was very much a kind of peer battle of, you know, who could make the best projects.
Sure.
And a lot of the people from my class have gone to really good things with their own companies or working. There's a lot of people working in the big companies. And actually, one of the main guys I used to work with, a guy called Mark Knowles, he's in our New York office now. So he joined us.
Oh, cool.
Not long after I joined. And he runs our New York office. And, you know, I kind of try to do a bit of the same in the London office. But yeah,
so London office is your first office?
Yes.
And it was the only office when you joined, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, London's been going 16 years and New York is coming into its fifth or sixth year now. So,
okay.
And the amazing thing is the studios are about the same size now. So
really?
New York has done really well.
How big are they?
So, I mean, it kind of depends on the day of the week, really. I mean, right. like a lot of people, we freelance up and down. So mm-hmm. There's normally about sort of, about 30 people plus kind of there on sort of full time, and then you could have another 30 on freelance on both sides of the pond, really. So on a, you know, on a busy day, there will be well over 100 people working for us.
Okay. But you guys are thinking about expanding some more, right?
Yeah. So there is going to be some new offices opening up.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm actually at liberty to say where right now.
You don't have to say fresh, it, but it was, just know that you're continuing to expand.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we're looking at some eruptions in the States. So, you
that's
know,
cool.
A lot of our business.
There's a lot of British companies are opening up in Los Angeles suddenly.
Yeah, I think we're
mostly focusing on advertising. So.
Yes, yeah. Well, we've been doing that for a long time.
Sure.
A lot of these companies have been doing film and then trying to kind of come back into advertising.
Right.
But I mean, we have our roots there, which when you look at doing out of home print stuff, which you know, the resolution of these images can be sort of 15, 20K sometimes,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, that's a big step up from doing HD.
Right.
And it's an entirely quite a different way of working.
Right. So you must distribute render a lot.
We do. We actually use tile rendering more.
Tile rendering. Why do you use tile rendering more? Because the frame buffer is smaller?
It's because we use Deadline for doing our rendering,
uh-huh.
And just the kind of queuing things up. You know, we do all our local rendering at small resolutions, and you know, if we got something particularly demanding, then we will steal some of the blades for distributed rendering. But kind of to maximize efficiency, it makes more sense to just throw them to the farm and let them just kind of tile render.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, find occasionally with the distributed rendering stuff, you can end up with machines that are assigned for DR, but they've kind of they finished their portion, but they haven't been released to go on to a next job yet. So
mm-hmm.
I've still got conversations to have with the great guys at ThinkBox to try and solve that a bit.
Gotcha.
And then hopefully we'll be able to use DR a bit more.
Right.
It's really good sometimes when we have problems with renders and we need to render fast, then you know we just grab all the machines and we can then see on the workstation what's rendering. We can use the target mouse to kind of move the rendering focus around. So if we really need a patch for a render, then we can make sure that section's done and we can just stop the render and just save that out.
Right. Yeah. I know that Vlad, no, it was Boris who was like showing me a video where he was testing some DR stuff on the cloud, on Google Cloud.
Yeah, I mean,
and he launched like 2,500 buckets or something.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I think I managed to have 100 blades, which were all 24 cores, in on my desktop once upon a time, which was that was quite spectacular to see for a quite a large render.
Yeah.
But we know we don't just do print stuff, and that's something that we have to keep telling people that we don't just do print. We do we do animation as well, and we do full scale TV commercials.
But I think and I know that I certainly don't want to take away from the diversity of your work you have, but I think there's something very interesting about the fact that you guys do print, because that's a medium that we don't discuss that much in terms of the CG world.
No, I mean, I think a lot of people don't even realize it happens. I mean, and that's kind of a credit to the CG print industry, is that a lot of the automotive advertising you see out there, where you see a car on a road, they didn't have that car there. They might have had a stand-in car that was last year's model, or kind of a similar pre-production one which wasn't quite finished. Yep. But most car advertising you see there, where it's print resolution, the car has been digitally put there. So, it's just a background that's been shot, and then, an HDR that's been used to, give us the starting of the lighting and the reflections and the shadows.
So, okay. So let's talk a little bit about the different types of projects that you guys over there. You guys mentioned cars. Well, what kind of car projects do you guys do? You said, well, for print, but also you do animations as well, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the stuff we're doing at the moment is for digital online. So there may be features of the car that the car
What do you mean by digital online?
So it's things that will appear on their website. So they'll have like we're going to launch our 2017 version of this car, and we're going to have a load of images highlighting all the new features, and we'll have some animation showing some of the features as well. And then there'll be things like configurators, which are massively complicated when you need to render sort of like thousands and thousands of layers that they can kind of bring them in. We just give them this kind of transparent PNGs, and they will put them into their website. And then when you're on there and you're like, hey, I want to see the car from this angle, and I want this model and this color, and I want to have this like accessory on, I want to have some roof bars on this, or I want to try and change the wheels over. So it's down to us to supply them everything in a way which means when they put the image back together again on the website that it looks like it was one render.
Right. Yeah. And that's that's crazy. So obviously you're doing compositing, you're doing everything else, right? And you also have to make sure your medium is not standard either, right? Because you're on a website, sometimes they have really skinny videos.
I mean, that's something that is always a challenge when you have suddenly, I mean, there's the skyscraper format, which is, I mean, it's like 100 pixels wide by 900 high. Mm-hmm. And then you've got like the opposite banner at the top, which is 900 wide by 100 high. And sometimes the clients are like, hey, can we just use this one image for all our layouts? And you're like, yeah, maybe. And
as long as you like a lot of cropping and space on the side.
Yeah, but these are things we have to like really plan out right at the start of the project when we're doing previs and doing our scene setups. We have to make sure that we've got everything laid out in the right way, and the client's happy, and they're happy that they got enough space. They have a lot of like legal copy to put on these things, and that needs to be readable, that needs to not be obscured. And most of the time they have a pretty clear idea of what they want to do. Occasionally they come back and say, hey, can we have like 5,000 extra pixels on the right hand side of this image, please? And you're like, it's like, you wouldn't really do that in photography, but yeah, I guess we can. So,
that's weird. Okay.
Yeah, so the world of advertising is very, very strange for individual kind of requests sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. We had Michael Wilkins from Saatchi, and Saatchi, he came on and was talking about, he works for Saatchi, so Saatchi is an advertising company. Just the way that you deal with cars is a challenge, right? Just having product specialists to know, no, that's the wrong keyhole, or that's that's the air dam from last year.
Probably majority of my inbox from the last 6 months is from product people saying, oh, that's wrong. Okay, so what's right then? And they're talking about oh, it's not shiny enough, or it's not reflective enough. And we're looking at reference photos for a car which maybe code red, where we can't get it outside. So we mm-hmm. have photos of it in a dark studio. And from that studio, you can't see, you know, is it that glossy? Is it, you right. can't really kind of see what it's yep. supposed to look like under studio lighting. And then a lot of what we do with automotive is you're making it look better than, you know, I shouldn't really say it's better than in real, because, right. you know, it's, if you just kind of took a car out in the street and you took a photo of it, chances are it's not going to look amazing. No. In terms of, you know, you're going to have some reflections going over the place. You're not going to have right. like the car pinging and all the angles and everything right. like that. So what we're doing is going beyond what's kind of real, and we're going to, you know, really beautify this. So, you know, we may use an HDR for lighting the car, but, you know, that only gets you certain, like, certain way through.
Sure. You need to, I mean, the same thing is true for car photography, right? They do all kinds of funky things to make car photography.
Yeah, I mean, they'll have spotlights that they'll wind up on and just kind of put in an angle just to kind of ping out all that lovely kind of flake detail that you get in the car paint, right. like sheet metal. And it's a real kind of dark art, that, and people don't really talk about how they do that. I've been lucky enough to be on a few shoots where I've been able to see how they nice. Do it, and that's actually influenced the way that I've like started teaching people to light stuff.
What have you, besides, you know, putting us, I mean, most of the time on car photography, it's usually one big huge area of silk on top, right? There's like a fisher
yeah bone. That, I mean, that kind of gives you kind of a base start. It's really important when you're kind of doing CG that you don't just have a planar light, because softboxes aren't like that. Softboxes fall off towards the edges. They kind of
they're very hot, definitely.
You know, they'll use things like, they'll put black silks down on the ground to put like extra contrast into the car paints.
Yeah.
And then the thing that we have to do, which is very much like print photography, where, you know, it might not be that we get everything in one render, mm-hmm. because the photographers won't get everything in one shot. Maybe they'll have one shot they're happy for the car paint, and they'll have another shot where they're happy for the chromes, and they're bringing bounce boards in and bringing lights in to ping up the alloys. And, you know, the actual main image, if we're just doing a purely photo retouching job, will be yeah. made up of a whole load of photographs.
So, yes.
And obviously, you know, with CG, we can do things like includes and excludes. You can mm-hmm. do like render subsets, things to kind of limit reflections in other objects. But sometimes, yeah, we're just going, you know what, let's just render this one, and then we'll just render another, and then mm-hmm. we'll render another pass, and we kind of have like, I don't know, five or six standard passes that we do for any car job. That just give the retouchers or the compositors the kind of the bits they need to.
Also gives them something they expect, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just like the standard things that everyone does. Like, you know, you need to have a ground shadow and AOs like separately and things like that.
Right.
And, you know, we chuck as many render elements in as possible. I remember telling Vlado the other day that there was some slowdown in 3ds Max. If you open the render scene dialog and you've got like over 100 render elements in it, it can take like 3 to 4 seconds extra to open. Mm. And he was like, really? You have more than 140 render elements? And I was like, yeah, sometimes. Like, it's, yeah. you know, we want to have masks for every material. We have masks yeah. for every layer. And, you know, it's however many masks you make, the compositors or the retouchers will always ask for more. They always want another one.
So we're
really interested in seeing what's going to happen with things like CryptoMat, where,
right.
you know.
But okay, let's go to CryptoMat a little bit. Let's a little side discussion. Don't you remember there used to be something called RPF? Right? Rich pixel format?
Yeah. But you've always got slightly dodgy anti-aliasing on the sides.
Well, sure, because
I mean, when you're in at print resolution, we are literally scrolling right into every single pixel.
Right. And I think CryptoMat's going to have the same problem.
Well, that's what I'm looking forward to finding out.
I mean, you can't change the laws of photography, right? You either have an edge that has 256 colors to choose from,
yeah,
in terms of smoothness, or you have one that has less than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that may save us is actually when we get to kind of retina displays. Like, I've got a 4K screen on my laptop, and uh-huh. one of the things I keep meaning to see.
Well, like, I shouldn't say it's horrible. It looks beautiful. My laptop has a 3.5K display, right, or something like that. It looks great, but then because I don't see any pixels, and the color is very rich and everything else. But then I can't scale anything correctly, and the dialogues of the windows are terrible.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to go. I mean, I think the hardware's kind of exceeded the software. It's going to be a few years yet before
the operating system itself also has a hard time.
I've had a lot of problems with Windows 10, kind of not scaling some apps. And things like Maya, thankfully, is HIDPI compatible, and 3ds Max 2017, they put a huge amount of work into getting that going. Like, I've been on the 3DS Max beta team for about the last like 8 years or something like that. And they had so much work to do because 3DS Max being like 25 years old, a lot of that technology was, the UI stuff was 25 years old.
Yeah.
So getting that updated in the way, like every single icon in 3DS Max had to be redrawn for 2017. And they're still going. So there's lots that they haven't done. And if you want to take a guess, how many dialogue boxes and how many icons there are in 3DS Max?
Okay, tell me. I can't even hazard a guess.
It's something like 6,000 icons.
Really?
And 4,000 dialogue boxes.
Wow.
And the crazy thing is they're going through these libraries and they're trying to work out, it's like, hey, is this icon even used anymore? Or is it like some utility which got used up a few years ago?
Wow.
And it's crazy when you actually look at it and you think how many dialogue boxes it's possible to open in these softwares, and you're just like, oh my god.
4,000 dialogue boxes.
4,000 dialogue boxes.
That's incredible.
I hope I'm not going to get in trouble with Autodesk for kind of revealing these.
No, assets. I mean, honestly, it just goes to show how mature that product is, right? It's been around for so long. Yeah. And cleaning it up is a good idea. But, next time you're wondering why it's taking 3 minutes to load Max, remember that it has 4,000 dialogue.
Yeah, well, it still has to. Thankfully, it won't have to load that other rendering engine, which we don't want to talk about on the podcast. That was Mr. Ray or whatever he was called.
Mr. Ray.
Mr. Ray.
Mr. Ray.
I always call it Mr. Ray.
Mental Ray.
Yeah, that one.
But we could talk about Mental Ray. We could talk about anything.
I haven't touched Mental Ray in over 10 years, so I don't need to talk about it.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's fine.
Has it changed in 10 years?
No, that was one of the problems.
I think so.
But I've heard that now that they're no longer with, they're changing.
There was some guy who tweeted, we got our plugins back, which is the, so who knows what's going to happen? It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, so I'm wondering what's happening with that other rendering engine now.
there's so many of them, isn't it? Yeah. But going back to the screen thing, when we have 4K screens, is that, are we going to see those edges? Are we going to see those pixels?
Does it matter?
Yeah, are we going to look back in a few years' time and go, oh my God, do you remember we have to worry about anti-aliasing? Maybe we won't soon. Maybe it'll be like,
you think the pixels will be so small that it doesn't matter?
You can't see the pixels on these screens. And I keep meaning to test it and just seeing what happens if you render fixed one. And does it, can you see a big difference?
Well, yes. You are going, you can turn off filtering. No. Yes. I mean, fixed one, you're still going to have a sampling problem, right?
Yeah.
But
it might be that you can get away with a lot lower tolerance on it because you can't see. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting.
Your TV still.
Yeah, I mean, but then in case if you're producing everything at Retina and it's kind of being downsized to go onto TV or anything like that, then is it going to kind of almost do the kind of area sampling by basically resizing?
First of all, let's talk real quick because I can geek out a little bit. The whole concept of
Are we geeking out? Are we not geeking out yet, Chris?
We are. But the whole concept of Retina.
Yeah.
It was funny because that was brought up by Apple, right?
Mm.
And I guess the rumor of the new iPhone 7 is coming out. The resolution of that phone is going to be less than most phones. It's actually, even though they're still considering it Retina, I think the iPhone 6 will only be 1920 by 1080, which is basically what it already is.
Yeah. Well, it's... once you've got to Retina, you don't really need to go above it. I mean, you can do a test where
I tell you why you do.
Oh, here we go.
It's VR.
Well.
Because the VR, if you're going to put the VR, this phone is very high resolution, or even the Nexus or the Galaxy S7 is very high res. It's ridiculous. It's like over 355 PPI, right?
Mm.
But when you put it in a Gear VR, you can see the pixels.
Yes, yeah. I hadn't thought about that. That's a good way to put it. But, but making the content which can go on those devices and mm-hmm. be pixel-less is the challenge. I mean, we're looking at doing a 360 still to get it really good quality on those things. It needs to be 16K around, which is a lot of image.
Yeah, I mean, the cube maps are pretty big. They're 18K by 1.5K, so they're pretty big.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. We'll have to think about it. All right. Okay, so what we went on all kinds of tangents here. What were we talking about? Okay, so your car stuff and where that background happens and your stills, and obviously you guys doing moving ones. What are some of the other big specialty things that you guys
do? So we do a lot in pharmaceutical. So
pharmaceutical.
Yeah. Now this is an area which, you know, when you kind of
where is your customers?
US? Well, a lot of US, because you guys seem to have.
We like to advertise pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, you really do. If like if you're listening to this and you've never been to the States and you haven't had the joy of sitting there watching television and then a 2 minute commercial comes on and to sell you a drug, and it's like I don't want to like know what drug I'm buying. I want the doctor to tell me. But over here it's a case of talk to your doctor about this drug, and they kind of, you know, say what it does, and then they spend like after about 30 seconds they spend the next minute and a half listing all the side effects.
Yeah,
it's like may cause heart defects, may cause death, and you're like, right, hang on a minute, this is scary. Like,
yeah,
but that means you then have, because you have all these caveats and all these warnings, you have a 2 minute TVC all of a sudden, which
and it's insane. And also we also pay an exuberant amount for our drugs.
Yeah.
So like, for example, so I was talking to someone the other day, he says, yeah, I have these bad migraines and I have this really great migraine medicine, but it's $50 a pill. So every time you have a bad migraine, you have to take this pill and it costs you $50.
Ouch. That's going to give you just a bigger headache. <you'll be. laughs>
It's true.
But yeah, I mean, it's obviously very, very strange coming from the UK where we have our fabulous NHS health service.
Right.
Okay, the government won't ruin it anymore. We don't have any of this, but that doesn't mean it doesn't still happen. There's a lot of like inter-pharmacy kind of selling where there'll be medical conventions where doctors, representatives from hospitals will go to these conventions, and people will be, generally what happens when a drug kind of gets to the end of its, you know, when somebody invents a drug, they have like a 10-year kind of like license to be exclusive, and then after that time
then it can go generic.
Yeah, so then other companies will do their own versions, and basically they're all the same, like within a kind of small, you know, few side effects and effectivenesses and things like that. So yeah, they have to sell them in, you know, using, you know, just like we, you know, when we have choice over cars, you know, all the cars are fairly similar, you know, they, it comes down to who's selling it in the best way. So they have these massive conventions where, you know, they're, and they put huge amounts of money into these things. They want to, you know, show their drugs in the best possible way. And they the whole thing about pharmaceutical is metaphors. It's, I really wish some of them, there's been some really interesting ones we've worked on lately, but there's some where it's kind of pretty much, hey, before you took this drug, it's a cloudy day, and now you're taking this drug, it's a sunny day.
Right.
So, but it can't be too sunny, because, you know, that would infer that the drug is
it's
kind
100%
of,
effective.
Yeah, you know, it's not like a kind of Popeye the Sailor Man, you know, da-da-da-da-da, like, right, hey, you've taken this drug, now you're 100% better. Yeah, that would be misleading.
And you have
you have the legal people who go through these things, and they check the concepts, they check the animations.
So strange.
And we've had the most incredible feedback, like saying, can you find a different take on this shot because the actress is smiling too much and we don't want to kind of infer that it's that good. So it's a very kind of, you have to, there's a lot of kind of constraints there when you have people constraining you from an artistic point, and then you have people constraining you from a legal standpoint.
I've seen that on there's ads. Like, I actually, luckily, I don't watch much TV anymore because I've sort of cut the cable, and I'm doing everything on Netflix and stuff. And I pay Hulu to not show me ads, so I don't actually see ads that much. But there's ones that always surprise me. Are the ones
you're missing out on all our fabulous work.
I know. But there's one on the. I guess for depression or something like that. You see this person just really sad, and all the color of the image is like desaturated in gray and blue. And then she takes a drug, she's smiling a little bit more. Like, yeah, she's just moving a little bit faster, but not like, all right, you know, she doesn't want to look bipolar either.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, from concerned to stoic. You know, that kind of level of change. But the really good thing about these like pharmaceutical campaigns is they sometimes are really creative and like really quite abstract.
Sure. Like the Cialis commercial with two bathtubs. That's very good.
I don't know that one, unfortunately. we did one that's fairly, as if you've been in the States, you might have seen, for a diabetes drug, and we had like an entirely paper world and this woman walking around, and it was a really cool shoot where we had to use a motion control camera and shoot some women and then shoot the world that had been model made at 1/12 scale.
Uh-huh.
And then we had to do like digital extensions and put CG characters in there.
Was that the one with all the paper? People are kind of made of paper and stuff? Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. That was all done in Meyer in our New York office.
Oh, cool.
So Meyer and VUA, that one.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, a lot of the things are still modeled in Max, but we kind of, we like to share and kind of use everything.
So it's what's interesting, and we're noticing it here as well, that, you know, there's a lot of Max people out there, and I don't necessarily think that Max is superior to Maya or vice versa. I think you're partially right. I think a lot of people think that Max is inferior to Maya, but that's not, I think they're at the very least, they're equal.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the great stuff like companies like Fuse and Blurdy with Max, and especially Fuse FX, the speed at which they turn stuff around, like for all these Netflix shows, like, so it's crazy.
It's true. And I think the reason that is because they're really good generalists, right? Yeah. And they've been trained as such, and Max is a really good tool for generalists.
Yeah, very much so.
So that, I think that's why that is.
And they have a really good pipeline as well. So
they
do.
But the problem is, especially in the advertising and, you know, broadcast world and even the film world, Max artists are just harder to find.
Yeah.
And you were having problems in your New York office.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely. Like, that's mainly the reason we use Maya there, is that the Max artists are quite hard to find.
Right.
But, you know, if we find a Max artist, they're actually more likely to be full-time employed. This is the discussion. I put a post up on CG Talk and it ended up in a flame war about software, where I was kind of like trying to raise a really legitimate kind of concern and saying, like, look, if you want a job, like a full-time like job in CG, it's like, if you learn 3ds Max, you'll find companies that will just grab you, because they're like, okay, well, our whole pipeline for the last 15 years has been 3ds Max. So,
right.
Well, yeah, you can come work for us. And I think that's why you hear a lot less of the jobs, because they are full-time. So you're not hearing them come up so much, but there's a lot of people in a lot of different industries, like automotive, aeronautics, military,
right,
huge amounts in ArcViz, of course.
Right.
But there is a lot of people doing advertising and animation TVCs in it as well, and TV effects. So, you know, just, you know, all the big film companies get all the big kudos, and everyone thinks, oh yeah, everyone uses Maya, and, you know, 3ds Max is dying. It's like, well, 3ds Max outsells every other 3D software put together.
Well, maybe not SketchUp.
Well, I don't think it's easy to buy set SketchUp.
Huh? There's a lot of people use SketchUp.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you're looking at Mac, you're looking at the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of users, right? Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people who,
and when
like,
you're looking at SketchUp, you're looking at the million users.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people who use Macs because it's bundled with other software, and, you know, it's
sure,
like industries where they're doing like design stuff, and then they kind of want to realize their designs, so they bring it into 3ds Max. They don't really know what they're doing, and they kind of follow some tutorials and kind of press some buttons and
sure,
you know, get a shiny object out of it and kind of happy with that.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I was going to plug my 3ds Max blog that I have. It's called Max Made Easy.
Max Made Easy?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
well, let's put it up on the podcast page.
Yeah, it's on Facebook as well, and I post loads of nonsense on there. And it's kind of, that's just like my outpour for kind of technical geeky stuff. So I do a lot of stuff like writing like tutorials on like how to do like Max script stuff, because that's the best thing about Max is like how quick and easy it is to develop and make stuff for. Like,
yeah.
It's way faster than writing stuff I found so far anyway myself.
Yeah. I don't know. I think they're all evil, honestly. I think a lot of them feel, I mean, I just wish they were a little bit more modern. Just like you said, you know, their interfaces have just got a lot of legacy in them. And in Maya, they're trying, but like, you know, the hypergraph is changed now, but it's still a pain in the butt, you know?
Yeah.
And Max is, you know, Max just pretty much stole, what was it? Nojo? Is that what it was called? Remember that?
Yeah, yeah, I know.
I think that's exactly what it is. Huh?
Yeah.
So
that's still pretty much that. I mean, they took on the developers of Nojo, so they're working their butts off getting this whole like high definition kind of transition working. You know, a lot of people at the moment are just like, well, that's not really relevant to me. I'm on like, you know, 1920 laptop, but you know, give it 5 years and every laptop you buy will be 4K, and you know, all this software has to work at this resolution. But
yeah,
you know, I know what the Autodesk team are doing. I know they're doing some really good stuff, and they have difficult challenges.
And you're part of their beta as well, right?
Yeah, beta and charter as well, which is where you kind of get to have an even more one-on-one time of go-to meetings, asking kind of before they've actually developed something, asking, you know,
what's the trends?
Like, yeah, it's like, what do you need with this? And, you know, they've changed a lot in the last sort of 5 years.
What do you think some of the trends are going to be in the next 5 years, if you can say?
Well, obviously the kind of VR thing is the thing that everyone, the kind of the buzzword.
Sure.
And I mean, there's a lot going on in the kind of photogrammetry stuff, which is, that's what I'm really interested in, that, like seeing like what you can get kind of almost for free, kind of in terms of like just going around, shooting a load of photos, chucking it into amazing software like Agisoft PhotoScan or Capturing Realities, or Reality Capture, whichever they want to call it, is incredible. And just kind of, you know, you're seeing models that are kind of hyper realistic that you could take you months to model, and they're just coming out in hours. But then the kind of next step is like, how do we record the hair? How do we record the fabric, the material scanning? How do we get that kind of automatic? And how do we kind of, you know, if we did photogrammetry somebody, how does it detect like their underlying body structure so that you've always got the cloth simulation automatic? You know, that's the
right.
That's what I look forward to in about hopefully 5, maybe 10 years time.
So it's almost scanning and then smart selection, right?
Yeah,
so
you can very
like,
much so.
Like the, oh, I already know that's a shirt and that's a pant and that's a shoe, and I can separate all those things out. And
yeah, I mean, that would be a really cool thing for, you know, getting, I think it'll probably be gaming that pushes that. You know, you'll stand in front of your PlayStation, your Xbox, and the Kinect thing will scan you, and then next thing you know, you're in the game, and you put your HTC Vive on or something like that, and then
sure.
you can see yourself, and it's you. And you know, I think there's some really kind of crazy stuff going on there.
But there's actually someone who was Ari Shapiro, I believe is his last name, but he's over at ICT, and he did a demo of making your own avatar in like 2 minutes.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
And so what he does is he does it all with like a Kinect or something.
Mm. Well, I saw some research from a place where they were basically, the idea was that you'd walk into like a fashion store and the scanners would scan you as you walked in, and it would, just from a video source, not from like photogrammetry, and it would detect, it would work out your body shape.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could like go up to one of these booths and you could see like what outfits they have that fit you, and you could like see how they fit on your body frame.
Mm-hmm.
And you could order things that actually fit you. And, you know, there's some kind of crazy things that could happen with that where, you know, these companies could almost profile the kind of clientele that are coming in, and they could make sure.
I think it's going to happen on Amazon.
Yeah,
they already know exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's all that kind of 3D printing. It's like, you know, it's going to be, you know, clothes made to, everything's going to be tailor-made soon, which is, it's going to be really interesting. And I'm always really interested where our industry kind of crosses over with all these other things like 3D printing and like checking out, I don't know, I know somebody who works in archaeology, and they're doing a lot of preservation of places by going and doing like photogrammetry, and they're finding some really interesting things. So this really cool story where they went and was up in Scotland somewhere, and they did a load of photos, put it into Agisoft, and then they turned off the textures, so they were just seeing the model, and suddenly they saw all these carvings that you couldn't see normally because they were under the texture of the moss and everything, and they found, and they were really like blown away by this.
Huh.
And then I know somebody who was involved with a project which is therapy for people who suffer from agoraphobia, and you have people who, you know, can't go out, they're really worried about going out in public with loads of people, and basically using VR, they, you know, they put this headset on and they experience going on the London Underground, you know, but being, you know, in the safety of their own home, and then, you know, they increase the number of people on it, and they kind of using that and other kind of cognitive behavioral therapy techniques to kind of let them, you know, gain some confidence and treat them, and, you know, it's been very successful. And I think that's really exciting and scary at the same time. That
I think I did that in Japan. Did you see the one about trying to help people with fear of heights or whatever?
Yeah, but I think it's scary though, because if it's got the power to kind of like heal, like kind of help you heal, then surely, you know, we're gonna, in a few years' time, we're going to be talking to people who've got like kind of fears of VR or have like having nightmares because of things that they've seen through VR.
Well, what was the conversation? I had this conversation yesterday. So, okay, imagine the person that's got a fear of heights, right? And so the video was put out there. It was in Japan, and it was very much kind of comical in a sense, because you had these people that are terrified. And the thing they had to do with fear of heights is they put on their headset. And it's a Unity display, not very high quality necessarily. And they have to walk out of this building on this plank. And
oh,
save
is that the one where
they
got the plank in the room that they're in physically, so they actually have to walk along it, and they can feel the edges of their feet.
Yeah.
I think the whole idea, because at the moment you wouldn't be able to see.
But you're only like an inch from the ground.
Yeah.
But they had to like rescue this cat, and these people are freaking out. They're like hugging the board, and it's really kind of funny. So, okay, so imagine they get over that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so great. So VR helped them get over that. But then imagine just like constantly introducing you to unbelievably hazardous stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it could be really stress-inducing.
And where you get completely used to it, and then you take the VR headset, and now you no longer have as much of a sense of preservation.
Or you're kind of used to there being a control Z, and right, you're kind of like,
wait a minute, I can't jump off the building. No, nothing happens.
I'm not in the Matrix. What's going on? I really see a lot of problems coming in a few years' time when people are really immersed in these things, and they don't. You look at like what's happened with like Second Life and games like that. But yeah. When people are really like massively immersed, you know, we're going to become a couch potato society where people have got these headsets on. I mean some of it's amazing. Like I'm planning on like taking the Samsung Gear VR to, I want to like put it on like someone who's like really old and let them kind of experience what it's like to sit on the edge of Victoria Falls like with right. National Geographic video. And I think it's really exciting for for people who kind of maybe can't go to these amazing places around the world and have a way for them to experience it. But I'm also hearing stories of like places in China which are opening up now where they just have VR studios, and you'll go there and you can go, I want to visit the pyramids. I want to visit Machu Picchu. I want to visit the Grand Canyon. And you do it in an afternoon, like in an hour. And it's, is that going to be good for preserving places? Because if you can go virtually, you're going to go on, the people who are going to record this stuff are going to do it on like the best day with the best sunrise and with nobody around, and they're going to edit everything out, and it's going to be this like perfect experience.
And everyone will do it in VR and no one will be there in the real time. Yeah. So maybe it'll be better.
Well, yeah, I mean, is that going to happen? We don't know.
I don't know. I mean, personally, I know people have heard me talk about it a little bit, but like, if I look at Pokemon Go as an example, right?
Yes.
Pokemon Go actually encourages you to go out and look for landmarks, right? So yeah. I go outside.
Well, that takes us on to the kind of next thing. Because, I mean, Pokemon Go is augmented reality, which I'm not a big fan of because just kind of like the hardware restrictions on it in our world, we can't do anything high quality enough for it. Then you got things like nose on stuff for VR, which is looking really exciting. But if you could combine that with the Microsoft HoloLens, I think the mixed reality thing is going to be really exciting.
Sure.
Where I was lucky enough to have a go on one a few months ago in Holland, because they're still quite rare, especially in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was incredible. I was really blown away by that because I couldn't believe how bright it was on the screen. And this is like the first release.
It's a very narrow view.
Yeah, I mean,
you forgive it. What's incredible to me is the tracking. The tracking is shocking.
Well, and the incredible thing is that there's no cables. This whole unit doing all this is on your head.
Yeah, all the computational power and all the tracking and all the cameras and everything is right there on your head.
I mean, if you get that down to, somehow get that down to, obviously not contact lens size, but maybe the contact lenses are the display, so you don't have to wear a stupid headset. And, just having that kind of interaction with the real world, you could end up like walking along and playing Pokemon Go by actually just seeing this thing like running around the streets. And there could be some really cool things for getting people out there. I mean, I'm quite a big fan of the mixed reality stuff because it doesn't kind of disconnect you from the real world.
No, exactly.
Because the thing
you can see through it, and I can see because
the first thing that happens when you put if you're in the office and you put the Samsung like Gear VR in your head or something, you put your noise cancelling Bluetooth speakers on, and you kind of like immerse yourself in that world, the first thing you feel is somebody like poking you in the side of the face because they're like, oh look, he's in the VR world, and it's like let's push him. You're like, it takes completely out of the experience.
Right.
Whereas mixed reality, you'll be able to see around you. You'll be able to kind of, I don't like the idea of like putting on a VR headset and sitting on a plane. I know somebody did that recently and watched a whole film while I was on a plane ride. But I think that kind of level of disconnecting from the world is dangerous. I think having like some kinds of cameras or something which allows you to kind of see through and still have some kind of awareness of what's around you is going to be a lot better. And I think it'll make people feel a lot more comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. I don't know. We'll see. I'm looking to see where it's going to go. I think that games and film are not necessarily the best VR experience. I'll take that back. That's the wrong way to say it. I think they have a lot to figure out to make them really good.
Yeah.
And I think that, let's take games as an example. It was like, oh no, games in VR, they're great. It's like, yeah, but the thing about games that have been around for a long time is that you can move around the world super fast, and you can't do that in VR.
Well, the thing I haven't done yet, but I really want to try playing like a racing game with the Gear VR with the HTC Vive on, because you're sat in a seat and you might have a steering wheel and pedals, and you know, just being able to move your head around and look at the wind, like look at the mirrors and things like that. I think that would be really immersive, and like flight games and things like that, where you are sat down and the world is moving through a vehicle.
Yeah,
I think a lot more of that happened. I mean, there are all these crazy things like these kind of like three dimensional treadmills and things like that, but I don't think I can't see those taking off. Like, you know, I think there'll probably be some kind of like neural receptor at some point, which kind of like you just kind of think about walking and it happens in the game or something like that.
Sure.
I mean, there's people looking at trying to, how can they solve the VR motion sickness? Because a lot of the problems with the VR experiences at the moment is that if your eyes are telling you one thing and your ears are telling you another, your brain goes, we've been poisoned. Like, eyes and ears aren't communicating. This is wrong. Like, the eyes said we're moving, the ears said we're stationary. Like, we've definitely eaten a poison. Let's throw up.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, it's if you do any, like, massive accelerations, your brain just can't cope with it. Like, smooth movements, is like, that helps. But, yeah, it's maybe there'll be some way where they'll be able to trick the ears at the same time. There's so many problems to solve. And that's something that's really exciting, is that we're at the,
I agree.
The emergence of this.
I agree. I think that there's going to be a bubble at some point where people are going to go, well, shit, you know, we put all this technology together, but we really haven't thought through how we're going
to
actually
I can use a Gear VR for about 10 minutes before like I start to feel a bit nauseous. So, you know, it's like when everyone's talking about using like VR for advertising and everything like that, and it's like, but when are people going to be using it? When are you going to get that in? And so, I mean, I think the experiential stuff is really exciting. You know, people, you know, you can have it in shopping malls and people can come up and they can have their 5-minute experience and they can really enjoy it. And, you know, will that take advertising, you know, full circle again, you know, to roadshows, people going around? You know, will we see like more human interaction because of it? I like seeing how these things comes in circles where, you know, we're looking at things. We like can look back and see how it was done a long time ago.
Instead of, you know, like for example, it's been off and on, but like one of the top products on the Vive is the IKEA kitchen.
Right? Yeah. Have you thrown the meatballs around?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I spent like 10 minutes doing that. It was brilliant. I mean, that's so
immersive. You see, the thing is, like, that's technically an advertisement for IKEA, right?
Yeah.
And whether you like it or not, it is. But the cool thing is, like, oh, I get to actually first person experience and play with the IKEA kitchen.
I'll tell you,
it's not a commercial for IKEA.
I'll tell you a funny story. I had a go on it, and I opened one of the drawers, like one of the low drawers, to get the frying pan out.
Yeah.
And then, without even thinking about it, I tried to use my knee to close the drawer, like I do in my own kitchen, where I just I open the drawer with my hand. Like, I'm quite a tall guy, so I'm going to reach down. I'll just like kind of kick it closed. And I tried to do that in VR, and of course, it didn't work. I was like, damn it. So, I mean, I think the next step, you know, getting full body tracking in there, and kind of a full body avatar is, where you'll be able to do that sort of thing.
Well, there was a video, it's kind of sad, but really, at the time, this little girl, and she was playing the Vive cooking game. I don't know if you remember the cooking game on the Vive. But she's shorter, right? So to her, like, all the counters are a little bit high and everything else. So she was trying to reach for something, right?
Yeah.
And so she reached her arm out, but it was still too far. So she tried to lean against the counter, but there was no counter to lean against. And so she just fell flat on her.
I chatted to Martin from IKEA about this, and like, you know, you're going to be able to experience what your kitchen design would look like to a child. Which I think is really exciting. And I think it's going to be really cool.
I had my kids in there, and then it was so strange because I'd put it on and I'm looking around, and then I gave it to my 6-year-old, and everything to him, the counter is like right up to his nose, right?
Yeah.
And I can see how he sees it from here, right? From by looking at the monitor on the computer, I can see, I was like, wow, he really is short, you know, and I know that because I can see him. But to him realizing, and I said, hey, Brady, do you want to see, you know, what it looks like to be tall? And he's like, nah, I don't want to be tall. Because my daughter tried it and she's 10, but to her it was like, whoa,
yeah,
it's weird being tall like this.
But so. Yeah, I mean, you could probably play some really interesting things like that, like going to, you know, what would it be like being an ant? You know, you could go to VR being right. an ant, and there's all these kind of like really cool experiences that, you know, people are yet to think of. That's the thing I really like seeing, like when really unique things come out. And but, you know, something like the IKEA kitchen, it just works. It's,
right.
And it's so simple. It's yeah. so simple.
Yeah, it's really cool. I really like it. I like it. I think it's effective. I think if people keep, and I've been saying it over and over and over again, like, we need to stop taking third-person experiences that yeah. are like stories or narratives or whatever and turn them into first-person experiences.
Exactly. And there's a really interesting, there's a filmmaker, she works for Google, I forget her name, but yeah. If you search for, you'll find her. She's made more VR films than anybody else.
Okay.
She does a really good, there's a YouTube thing where she did this whole talk, and she talked about how, like, you know, as a person there, you're there, like, you can, you know, normally in cinema.
Is she the journalist?
No.
Okay, but she, I forgot her name.
She lived there in California.
Okay.
in LA. She was like, you know, the camera becomes a person. So in traditional cinema, you wouldn't have somebody look straight at the camera and talk to the camera. It's very disconcerting for that to happen.
Right.
But in VR, that actually feels really natural.
Right.
And there's like really interesting things. Like the first thing that people do when they put the VR headset on, and you'll probably notice this from now on, is that they look directly behind themselves. And she made this really nice little short film where you start the film and you're suddenly in a bedroom. And in the corner of the room, there's a little girl playing the violin. And you're looking at this. And then what happens, everyone looks over their shoulder and there's a doorway, and there's like, you can just see there's like her parents just kind of peeking through, which I think is really nice. Is that kind of like you're suddenly in a moment and you're kind of naturally kind of trying to inspect and see what it is. And
right.
just there's so much like narrative that's, and kind of like language of the VR that hasn't been established yet. How do you make somebody look somewhere? Like, how do you know where they're going to, where the likely cut point is? Not just in time.
Is there a cut point?
Or where?
What is a close up in VR?
Well, you don't really have that, but it's more a case of like, if you've got a 360 degree view, okay, you know where the people are going to start. But if you're going to cut, where are they going to come out of? Are they going to start? Are they going to finish at the same point, or will they have like turned around 180 degrees? And therefore, you've got to take a guess about where they're going to be looking at the end of a sequence, so that then when you start the next sequence, you've got the point of interest at that point.
Sure.
And she does this whole really interesting thing about like circles within circles within circles, and you can see where somebody starts and ends, and make sure that they all overlap.
Well, definitely let me know.
Yeah, no, well,
because I'll put that on a page too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, you know, we're talking about all this stuff at the moment, and it's stuff that is for us is still so fresh and new. I mean,
absolutely.
We've been doing. I mean, we did a few like sort of 360 like images a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Did a really nice one. It was looking like Leonardo da Vinci's like workshop. We did that a few years ago, and that's quite nice. We've been able to put it up on Facebook now, and actually people interact with it properly. And we've been looking at doing like VR video, and you know, it's really easy with V-Ray to do like full 360 like stereo 3D,
right?
And you know, we're trying to discover, you know, what works, what doesn't work. And,
sure.
And there are so many things to consider, but at least actually kind of making the images is fairly easy at the moment.
That's a solved problem.
Yes. Yes.
Cool. All right, well, I want to, because I know that your ride's going to be here soon and you've got another appointment, so unfortunately I'm going to have to cut it short, and I want to make sure that you have a chance to talk to Stephen. So let's go ahead and hopefully Steven's back. But it's been great having you here.
No,
thanks
great.
So much.
No, great. It's been really good fun.
It's been fun. I'm glad you told me that you're going to be in town and we can make this all work out, because that's awesome.
Cool.
All right. Well, thanks so much, David. Appreciate it.